Good morning. Today is Tuesday, November the 17th. Joining us this morning from parts unknown, Yana Valakovic from the California UC Cooperative Extension at Spruce Point. Sometimes that's where she is. Sometimes that's not where she is. Good morning, correspondent Yana.
Good morning.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We don't want to give away any hints at this point of where she's located. All righty, Winston, why do we say it?
I was watching The Invisible Man the other day, and I was reminded of this. Where is the sense in the expression, "Here we go gathering nuts in May"?
Nuts in May?
I have not a clue, unless it's at the grocery store.
I've never heard of the expression, so it must be some kind of a tree that produces nuts.
The word nuts in that expression is actually referring to knots, in other words, sprigs of flowers, and these do come out in the month of May.
Oh, some more seeds.
Ah, collecting flowers. Now I get it.
Or corms, or some kind of...
Yeah, okay, you could say spores, too, if
no,
you...
No, I said corms, you know, like a bulb of some kind.
Yeah, okay.
Something that's edible.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, breakfast.
Yeah. I mean, sunflower seeds might not be ready in May. But
No. I'm not even sure you can get...
Something in that. Could be a plant like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure you could get any pollen. Hey, I got a really off-the-wall question before we start. Why do Monterey pines grow so well here?
Well, they do and they don't. Monterey pines, the climate where Monterey's climate is pretty similar to our climate on the coast in Northern California, so they do just fine in that way. I think what people don't recognize about Monterey pines is they're a rather short-lived species. So after like age 60, they all pretty much start to fall apart. One of the most common questions I get, my Monterey pine looks terrible. It's like, well, yeah, they really don't have they're not long-lived.
Well, and for some of us, they never looked good to start with. Those things have got to be the dirtiest tree around, and I know that they're prevalent. I know a couple of the developers in the mid part of last century, that was their tree because they grew fast and they were evergreen, and I guess they wanted something maybe with lower branches than what redwood trees would permit. But yeah, those things have got to be one of the dirtiest trees that are evergreen also.
Yeah, and you say dirty because the material that comes down?
Yeah. You know, the pollen, the needles, not necessarily the branches of the tree, but they tend to do that as well.
Yeah. I mean, the pollen is a lot. It is a lot. And then you get the good molds on the pollen.
Right. Now, are they related to any of the coastal pines that we have in the area?
Well, we get shore pine here. I mean, they're definitely the pine family. I don't know their genetic history, but you know, the pine that grows on our coast are shore pine primarily.
Yeah, yeah.
And then to the south, we can get some other pine species. But
okay, that's all for my weird question. I just
weird tree questions. We love them.
Yeah. Oh, with the winds that we've had so far today, and I guess what we're supposed to have for the next day or two, I think for folks that are either traveling to our areas, you know, leaving other spots, I mean, we certainly see a lot of RVs now that we haven't historically this time of the year. What are some of the do's and don'ts about being in the forest or being in the woods during windstorms? What should they be looking for?
That's a great question. Have you ever heard the term widowmaker?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So a widowmaker is when in a high wind event, you either get the top of a tree blown out or a branch knocked off, and it free falls, and often silently. I think that's the most amazing part about it. And when it free falls, you certainly don't want to be underneath it and become a widow. So for those of us in the forestry world, we always wear hard hats when we're in the woods. And if we have the choice on windy days, we try not to be there.
I would suspect even a pine cone or a redwood cone from a certain elevation could kind of get you a little dizzy, too.
I would think so. We were up in Del Norte County yesterday doing a bunch of forest management work and had to curtail our work today because of the wind.
with, I suppose, you know, you talk to some of the old timers, you know, and the Widowmakers weren't the thickness of your finger. They're, you know, 7, 8, 10 inches around the old branches, you know, from the big trees. And then they get caught in the other branches. So sometimes it isn't even a wind or a breeze that triggers these things coming down.
Oh, that's true. I mean, as the trees get knocked around, branches get dislodged. Sometimes they've been hung up in the canopy for a long time. And so when, you know, the trees start shaking around in the wind, then those can get triggered and free fall down. I remember one experience where I was leading a tour, which is always the worst time to almost have a fatality, and I was standing on a little wooden bridge, and I did not hear the Widowmaker coming down, and it, you know, I could feel the rush of wind as it just grazed the outside of my face and went straight into the creek and stood straight up and lodged itself deep into the bank.
That a come to Jesus moment, huh? I was the old highway north of the national park, or I guess in the national park, and heard a crack, which is always a crack from up top. It's never a good indicator that life is going to stay as it was. So we kind of moved rather quickly, and it was just maybe a 4-inch diameter that had got hung up there. But the impact when it hit, from whatever height it was really sobering.
Yeah.
Is there...
And then they kind of explode. Yeah. Maybe this is nerdy, but one of the things, you know, redwood is a tree that sprouts and has the capacity to form all kinds of different plant structures. And I like to play this little game. When you see smaller diameter, kind of off-looking trees, I sometimes wonder if those are branches that came down from the canopy.
Right, got stuck and sprouted. Yeah, yeah.
And then formed new root tissues and did the whole thing.
Interesting stuff. And we'll talk about more of that when we come back. It's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS. News and information time. It's 8:23. We're back talking shop this morning with Yana Valakovic. Yana, the wind dynamics, you know, they talk about trees that don't blow with the breeze will snap off. Branches will snap off. Is some of this that we experience during windstorms, even though there's debris on the road or on the trail or on the forest floor, is that part of a forest being healthy, kind of cleaning some of that, the old stuff up, or snapping off the old trees or bending them, you know, that kind of stuff? Is that part of a healthy forest dynamic?
That's an interesting question. I mean, what it does do is it makes, when you break a top off on a tree, you get defects. So from a, you know, wood quality and a commercial perspective, it's not so good. But, you know, if your goal is about making habitat and making structural complexity and creating little nooks and crannies and places for different critters to live, or, you know, I don't know if you're following that whole thing with redwoods. I mean, there's so much life in those upper canopies of older redwood forests, and complexity and little nooks and crannies are really important for all of that to form. So it does, you know, create places that might not otherwise be in a rather, you know, uniform and cylindrical forest. I think wind, for the most part, though, you know, brings down the old needles, brings down the old leaves, and most of the nutrients in forests come from their leaves, not from the wood itself. Wood is just carbohydrates. so when you're looking to recycle that nitrogen and phosphorus and calcium and other essential nutrients, they're often in the needles and the leaves. So bringing that down and starting the decomposition process is great.
As you look at some of the different types of forest management that have been practiced over the last, I don't know, pick a time frame, 50 years, 75 years, 5 years, whatever it is there this managed part rather than just selective harvesting? Is there a mix, optimal mix of species in one of the coastal forests?
I think that's the amazing part about our coastal forests is that they're quite diverse. And, you know, it's very different than growing like a plantation like you would see in the South, where you just grow one commercial species and there's no mix of tree types in there and plant types. It gets pretty homogenous. And so, you know, we call this kind of native forest management. And, you know, it's really hard to just grow one type of tree in our forest. It takes a lot of effort to control that. So you get, you know, natural feeding in or natural sprouting of different tree species. And so those might not be the ones that you planted, but it creates diversity. And, you know, I think we can all appreciate that having genetic diversity is important for being able to buffer things. And, you know, there's forces of nature that come in from the outside that you can't always manage. And so some tree types do better in response to different natural disturbance regimes. So, or diseases or climatic changes or, you know, drought. So having a diversity is, you know, generally a good thing.
A lot of folks, particularly if they're not of the area, will go through some of the parks and see some of the trees that are horizontal. They've been blown down, mm-hmm. fallen down, you know, somehow they're down on the ground. And let's pick a normal one. Say it's a 10-foot diameter tree.
Mm.
Okay.
Big redwood.
How long does it take for something like that to really break down?
A big old growth redwood, really a long time, very, very long time. I don't think I could put a number on it. I think what amazes me is, well, this actually can relate to something I did last week, but I studied the Canoe Fire, which was a lightning-ignited fire in 2003 in Humboldt Redwood State Park and then burned onto some private forest land. And it was the first fire we'd had in old growth redwood for over 50 years, and really in second growth redwood. And so people just didn't know that much about how, you know, what happens in wildfire in redwood.
Right.
And in the Canoe Fire, you know, you would see that, and the Canoe Fire was not super intense. The flame lengths were relatively short. They were only like 6 to 12 inches, though the burn line was about 20 to 30 feet up the boles of the trees. So people interpreted that dark char line as, you know, 20 feet of flames. But what happens in redwood is the fire kind of wicks up. It sort of smolders up the outside of the redwood trees. And so it gives an appearance of greater flame height than what actually occurred. And in some cases, actually, the diameter at the base of these redwood trees shrunk as a result of the fire, because the fire consumed some of that outer bark and made it a little skinnier. But back to your question about those big logs that come down, what I saw is that, you know, it kind of punked around, it nibbled at some of those logs, but for the most part didn't really engage in those and didn't really, you know, lead to much loss or consumption by fire. Now, I contrast that. Over the last week, I went down to Sonoma County to see two fires that burned in second growth redwood stands, both privately managed, one right on the coast called the Myers Fire right above Fort Ross, and then the other one called the Wallbridge Fire just west of Healdsburg. And those were both part of the lightning series that we had this late summer. And those fires burned ridiculously hot. And I didn't have the advantage of knowing what the stands looked like beforehand. They were second growth, but each of the landowners said there was quite a bit of wood on the ground. I don't think they're in the 10-foot diameter size, but a lot of wood burned that was on the ground, which led to a really hot fire on the soil and towards the roots of the tree. So a lot of difference based
on the environment. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, in those cases, I think we are losing some of those redwood trees. At least they're above ground parts.
Right.
Which is something you don't see very often, that redwood is killed. You can see branches burned. But they'll leaf right out.
But not
it.
The tree, right, right. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
Hi, my name is Keith Lund. I am an electrician for Owsley Electric. You can go into a trade, be 18, become a trainee. They do require some education. You have 120 hours of classroom education, plus you have to work 2,000 hours a year. So after 4 years, then you can go out and work for another company, getting your own certificate, become your own boss. There's quite a few options you can do.
Own your future and learn more about the Trades Academy at hcoe.org.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:36. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic from the California UC Extension. Talk shop presented by CDH Painting, REDEC, Humboldt Termite and Pest Control, and Murphy's Markets. Jana, considering some of the different challenges that are out there, doing normal has got to be kind of a bit of a relief to be able just to do what you used to do before. Have you had many opportunities at that?
Well, you know, one of the things I've been able to keep going, this may shock listeners, but we had to justify any activities outside starting in March when all the curtailments came in. And I was able to justify essential research for plant quarantines and business commerce. I do a lot of work in a particular forest disease called sudden oak death, and I was on the trail of it in Del Norte County, which was disease-free, and I was hoping to maintain and continue to prove that. So over the last 8 months, I've had a lot of field days in Del Norte, which has been great, really beautiful place. I'm totally falling in love with the Smith River and the Oceanside, and just a lovely place. The bad news was that in the process, I ended up finding the disease and ended up... So that's the first time in Del Norte County, which means it gets added to the quarantine counties, which have restrictions on plant movement. So I've been trying to help all the industries manage and mitigate those. But the worst news was that we learned it was the European strain of the disease, which has not been seen in California ever, which triggered basically an emergency response. So yesterday I was in Del Norte, was curtailed today because of the rain and wind, doing some emergency disease management and trying to remove the infestation to prevent additional spread and hopefully confine it to this one site.
So how does something like that, I mean, one, if you say oak trees, a lot of people are going to go, not here. Okay. Yeah, there are. Just drive and you'll see the leaf colors. They're a little different. But how does something like that get here?
Well, it gets here because we all love to plant our yards up with beautiful woody shrubs. And this disease got into the commercial trade of rhododendron, viburnum, pieris, and a number of, like, almost all of our big, showy, woody plants that we plant our yards with. And it doesn't necessarily have a real strong signature on those plants. And it, you know, bypassed review. And then what happens is folks, you know, bring those back to their yards. And if their yards are close to the forest land, the disease can kind of smolder on those shrubs for a while and then kind of hopscotch into the forest setting. This disease primarily kills tan oak and coast live oak. Coast live oak occurs down in the southern part of, like, you know, southern Mendocino and south. And, you know, people don't get super excited about tan oak. But the problem with finding the European strain is that it also happens to be pretty aggressive on conifers.
Oh, really?
So the implication to our forest products industry is something that I'm very aware of. And that's why we've been all hands on deck, working together across agencies and organizations to respond as quickly as possible.
So in a situation like this, when you are in crisis mode, okay, let's say you go in and you obliterate the 5-acre square that you're looking at. That wouldn't preclude it coming in on the next shipment from a nursery of roadies that are in, and they get planted, and you're kind of back in the same boat in a couple of years.
That's the challenge. And so there is an intensive inspection process of all production nurseries in the United States. And then there's been a massive educational effort for nursery managers to try and figure out how to not create conditions that are ideal for this disease and diseases like it. So there's been a huge improvement in the nursery industry. This disease is caused by a water mold. It's also kind of fungus-like. It's got spores, but it needs wet, moist conditions. So changing times of day when you water, lifting plants up so they're not in contact with the ground, basically trying to shut off accidental disease transmission in the nursery has been part of the whole strategy. What complicates this, and I think I find really interesting from an international commercial trade perspective, is that we still allow for the importation of plants from countries far and wide in soil. And so the challenge for the inspectors is that they have a known list of bad actors that they look for when these plant shipments come in. But the potential for something new to come into our borders is pretty strong. And what we're seeing is, like, every year there's a new country that starts up in commercial plant production.
So if it's a bare root shipment, then you're far less likely to have some of the nasties?
Yeah, I mean, this may sound a little extreme, but I wish on that level, from the international plant trade perspective, that we only imported tissues and we did tissue culture production, meaning that we would grow them here with clean, sterile tissues and then not have soil movement from other countries to this country.
Oh, instead of grabbing it out of a nursery planter bed, so to speak, and stuffing it in a box.
Exactly.
And shipping it.
Exactly, because, we get, California gets new pests and new diseases every year in the tens of numbers, and you don't know what it is until it starts to manifest, and that's often too late. And, the impact to business as a result of it is significant. And so I just kind of wish we were in front of this one, at an international level, so that things didn't hopscotch around so much. This disease likely came from Europe through the commercial rhododendron trade originally. But, rhododendrons can be produced anywhere worldwide now and shipped here.
Right, right.
It doesn't mean that they'll be inspected, but they'll be inspected only for the known list. And, we can only look for what we know. What's lurking in the soil environment, it's really hard to tell. What scans you would do to confirm that it's, clean enough to come in. It's really complicated and then expensive, too. So,
yeah.
Do you want the idea of more...
You don't want your $500 roadie to go to be infested, ripped out, or just be a carrier. Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:42.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission wants you to know that local economic development agencies, business resource organizations, financial institutions, and jurisdictions are working together to provide resources for the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, go to NorthCoastSBDC.org or call the OES Business Hotline at 268-2527. 268-2527.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic. Jana, some of the nurseries, the feeder nurseries to our local retailers are regional.
Right.
But is that any kind of a guarantee that those plants aren't serving as a carrier?
The challenge is that there's always a potential. We've done a lot of education of our local retail nurseries, and I feel really great about all of them. I guess here's what I recommend to the general consumer is if you buy something on the off-sale rack, really watch it. There's often a reason why it's on the off-tail rack, and you know, a lot of plants are given fungicides as kind of a prophylactic treatment, and you know, outside of that environment, things can manifest. So sometimes we encourage people to set it aside before you plant your garden and make sure it remains healthy, or avoid the off-sale rack in general.
Just kind of let it sit on the deck or the porch.
Mm-hmm. For, you know, maybe 2 months or so, and make sure, I mean, take care of it for sure. Don't
right. do that. But. Yana, it's dead. I don't know. You're just sitting. Oh, yeah. You didn't water it. Okay.
But, I mean, we're all, you know, our world, we're all connected. And, you know, none of us want to hitchhike something home, just like none of us want to have corona. So it's all kind of the same stuff. But
yeah. Now, do certain fertilizers tend to accelerate the growth, or?
No, not so much.
Okay. So Miracle-Gro, as an example, isn't going to cause the
no.
nasties to grow a little bit more or take them out?
No.
Okay.
No. And, I mean, when things look bad, they look bad. And so, you know, then in that case, don't put it in your compost pile. Like, actually throw it away.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is just, you know, right. put it in your compost.
Spread it through the entire yard. Yeah.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, have fun stomping out in the woods and finding more
Thank
stuff.
You.
Okay. Thanks, yep. Yana. See everybody tomorrow.
Bye, everyone.